Hey, what's up, everybody? Welcome back to yet another episode of Millennial Musings. And as always, I'm your host, Anurag Ramchandran. Now, one of the biggest challenges that we are facing today with the lockdowns and other forms of social distancing is the deterioration of our mental health. As we come to terms with our new realities, we can often feel the stress, anxiety, and depression associated with these massive lifestyle changes slowly creeping in. And you know, some of us deal with this quite well, others not so much so. And I definitely fall in the latter category. So I wanted to unpack this further with an expert, and I brought on board for this very episode, Ruchita Chandrasekhar. She's a psychologist and researcher who is going to help us address some of the mental health challenges that we are facing today in light of the coronavirus-related isolation. We talked about some of the common challenges that, you know, you and I have been facing over the last several weeks, some wider global trends, and then we ended the conversation with Ruchita's recommendations to navigate these testing times. I definitely learned a lot, and honestly, I think you will too. So without further ado, let's jump straight into the episode. And as always, thank you for tuning in. Ruchita, thank you so much for joining Millennial Musings. I'm so excited to have you here. This has been something that I've been really looking forward to talk about, something that I'm sure a lot of us are going through right now. But honestly, thank you so much for joining, and I'm excited to have you here.
Happy to be here. I hope I can help provide some insight. And this is going to be an interesting topic to address in these crazy times.
Yeah, and that's right, you know, absolutely crazy. But before we dive into a little more about, you know, what we are all going through right now and, you know, the craziness of the times, can you just tell us a little bit more about yourself, your background, and we'll get started from there.
Sure. So I am an independent psychologist. I have a specialization in trauma and post-violence recovery through my work. I trained in Chicago at the Chicago School of Professional Psychology. I worked with a host of diverse communities over there, but then my primary work experience after a point was with the U.S. Federal government at their immigration detention center. So I worked with the Office of Refugee Resettlement, Department of Child and Family Services in Illinois, stuff like that. And then I came back to India in November. Since then, I run my independent practice online. And I'm also a qualitative researcher. I'm about to apply for my PhD, so I also consult with organizations on projects that look at the intersectionality of marginalization in healthcare resources and mental health from a trauma-informed lens. So doing a lot of trauma-focused projects like that and trying to provide more mental health education in the country in this context with also just like a South Asian cross cultural lens to it so far.
Ooh, fantastic. I mean, the best part about this is that there's so many things we could unpack, especially given your background, you know, like you have like the psychology, like you're a psychologist, you know, so you come in as an expert, but also you're a researcher and you've got so many of these other interests that I'm really keen on exploring. So this is going to be a long one. and I hope I don't tire you out with my questions. But let's get started, and I think there's no better way to start this out than like talking about some of the things that I've been going through in these last 3-4 weeks now of social isolation, you know. And in 4 weeks, I think I've left my house like twice, you know, and each of those times to just go get groceries, stock up over here, and you know, largely my only interaction, my only personal interaction, has been with my security guard in the building that I live in, you know. So crazy times, just absolutely different and difficult for someone like me who's an absolute extrovert, loves people and company. But there are actually three things that I've noticed in my end, especially, that has, you know, kind of clearly shown me the departure from my regular life, you know. So the first one is like complete break in routine. From, you know, how I used to like go about my day previously to right now. And, you know, we'll obviously unpack this in just a second. The second one is like isolation from friends and family. It's a complete readjustment when you can't, you know, get in touch with the people that you care about or be around them or, you know, indulge in that experience of sharing the same space with them. And the third one is separation between work and personal life. You know, nowadays everything seems to just flow into each other, and there doesn't seem to be any kind of clear distinction between when work ends and when my personal life begins, or when my personal life ends and when work begins. So these are like the three things, but we'll dive into each of them individually. Don't want to throw all of them at you. But let's start with the break in routine part, right? So if you can talk a little bit more about it, I'm sure that a lot of people are facing this, especially like a complete change in their regular routine and approach.
Mm-hmm. So the break in routine is a very appropriate response because life doesn't look the same anymore. I often talk about how we're not designed to just go about life as usual during a pandemic. This is high crisis. Your brain goes into survival mode. So, and we're all functioning on, say, a baseline level of stress, whether it is through anxiety, whether it is through stress that comes from other sources, whether it is activating other mental health concerns. So it's rare that someone's functioning on a baseline neutral mood right now. Given that, and given just how much adjustment stress there is with getting used to what is put out in the news, thinking about how you have to now adjust your life in accordance with that, worrying about your loved ones, this, that, your time and energy is occupied by so much that has never been a part of your routine. So in the light of all of that, it is not the most realistic expectation to have the same routine as you've had before, because you weren't surviving a pandemic before this.
Right. Absolutely.
Which is why I think it's important to just have some flexibility in that, to see what is doable, to see what is not doable, and to keep reminding yourself that it's not doable within good reason.
Yeah.
That it is an appropriate stress response. Like, I was talking to someone yesterday who told me that they've been thinking about like past triggers and just like past stressors have started coming up more and more because the whole their whole life feels like it's on pause right now and it doesn't make sense, and that is making them upset. And they couldn't understand why that is making them upset.
Right.
It's just like, that's part of the human experience. That is an appropriate response. This is the new normal now. So it's shifting. That's what it could be because of.
And I actually really resonate with what the person that you were talking to the other day said about, it just feels like a lot of my past triggers are readily making themselves more available. And maybe it's because, you know, we have a tendency to put ourselves into our work or our surrounding or current environment. Now that I, like, to a certain extent, have time at hand where I'm sitting at home and, you know, I'm idle, that some of these, like, past things, like, oh, why did I say something like this to that person and why did they respond that way? From something as little as that to something, like, really, really big, as in, like, well, when I left that said country, I had this experience which I completely ran from. So I don't know if this is it commonplace? Is it expected that these kind of triggers are going to take shape over and over again? And if that happens, like, what is it that I tell myself? What is it that I tell my mind? If you have anything on that.
I think it is pretty commonplace because now you're in an unprepared pause, but you're in a pause. You have, like, things have paused for you, right? Like, usually when we go from one thing to another, you're constantly moving. So you have different things to keep focusing on, which is what, through a distraction or through just having your focus in multiple places, helps you cope or just put things on the back burner, like things you haven't possibly processed entirely, right?
Sure.
Now it's, they have time to catch up with you. So they're bound to catch up with you in that light, you know? So I think it is pretty normal to experience that. One thing that I keep telling people is also just like, if there is a time to process something, it could just be now because the whole world is on pause. Yeah. And like, where is time going anyway? So if there is something that your brain's letting you know you haven't dealt with this, hey, you have time now. Can you draw attention to this? Again, doing it within good reason. And it is in with checking in with yourself as well to be like, why is this coming up now? How has this reframed my thinking about this situation in this time? What are emotions that are coming up for me as well? And to also recognize that that is also going to be an exhaustive process, which is going to hamper your routine.
Yeah.
So what was your question with that again, though?
Because No, you definitely did. I was just asking you as to, like, is it a normal circumstance and, like, what can we do about it? And I get from you that, yes, it's very normal. And, like, perhaps even, like, channeling our thinking to see this as a positive, right? Like, in terms of, like, when else would I have the time to process this? When else would I have time to like revisit some of, you know, the past and like try to address them or even go into a deeper hole about some of these things?
And I think what also happens is that we're always trying to do something about it, like fix it. When sometimes it's in just like not doing anything about it and just like riding the wave as well. Right? We're, because in our everyday life outside of this pandemic, we tend to have also very solution focused thinking to different things. We're trying to problem solve, decision make. Yeah. We want to see outcome. We want to see what is tangible, what is not, things like that, right?
You're talking the same language of my workplace here. That's what consultants do.
Exactly, exactly. So that is the line of thinking you're very accustomed to. Yeah. It doesn't apply right now. And it doesn't always apply to personal circumstances as well. There are some places that works in, there are some places it won't work in. So sometimes the answer is also isn't not, how do I fix this? It's just like, how do I let this be and just see how I can ride this wave?
Yeah, that's really helpful. And it's like, it's almost a positive spin on the entire situation, right? Like from a feeling of helplessness, like, oh my God, like all these things are, you know, resurfacing to being like, wait, when else could I think about this? And I like really like that. I was just wondering if we can move on to that second point that I was talking about, which is about, which is I think been even more prescient to me right now, you know, it's isolation from friends and family. So giving you a little bit background, family lives in Dubai. Most of my friends are in the US. And spread out across the world. And I have no access to my friends in like the my friends in Bombay. And more importantly, I live by myself in a studio apartment. So there's a lot of things here, right? Like, and added on to this is a couple more layers of me being an absolute extrovert who loves hugs, who loves like, you know, spending time personally with people. How has the onset of lockdown and coronavirus and all this, like what trends are you seeing that it's shaping our lives to become more, you know, physically isolated, but also more socially interactive, you know, through online and all of these? If you can talk a little bit more about that.
So I think it's changed the way we look at social interaction, right? Because I can't imagine how stressful this is for you. Yeah. One, to be physically away from your loved ones in the time of a pandemic and with having like a baseline level of anxiety for their health, but in also knowing that your accessible support system is not accessible anymore.
Yeah.
Which often will amplify the feelings of isolation because there is a degree of like, okay, I have to be alone to protect myself, but being alone is also stressful for me. So how do I now take care of this? Because there are things you can control and there are things you can't control about this. So what I have seen is there are a host of people who are very comfortable with this because they feel like this is very second nature to their personality.
Right.
Or an interesting thing that I also noticed was in the people I see, I work with, some of whom have high depressive symptoms, it got worse. And then in some of their cases, it became suddenly a little more managed because they're like, now everyone is isolated.
Right.
Now everyone is feeling helpless to some degree. So it's like somewhere they know, they don't know how I feel, but then it's like this familiarity of like, okay, there's company in this now as well is also like an interesting thing that I noticed.
Right.
But as an extrovert, when it comes to, say, like emotional challenges, what are some of them that you've been experiencing because of isolation?
Yeah, and I'd say there's a positive and negative side to this as well, right? So I'll start with the challenging, the negative side of things, which is that I feel like I, to a certain extent, I require a personal, like person-to-person physical interaction, be it with loved ones, be it with my friends. My choice of location where I live right now was also hinged on that, you know, like that I want to be able to just walk over to my my buddy in the next building or like, you know, have a party nearby where I can just easily access. And so in that sense, it's like on days in which I have like exhausting amounts of work or that I don't have much work where I'm really feeling that sense of isolation, it really hits me hard that I don't have that outlet, that I couldn't just like pop into my friend's house or just go spend some time and get this off my mind, right? But on the flip side, the positive has been that a ton of my friends that I haven't been able to catch up with as a result of like distance, or be it, you know, time difference, or all of these things. They're all, you know, online, and all I need to do is set up a time that works for everybody, and I have that closure, you know, that I have that time to catch up with them. So a lot of friends that I haven't spoken to in like 2 years, apart from like just a WhatsApp message or a Facebook message, I've really caught up with their lives now. But on the flip side, the friends that I can like physically spend time with, not quite so, you know?
Yeah, which is so strange, right? It's a strange sense of community in the time of an isolation.
Absolutely. And I don't know how to feel about it, you know, because the distance feels sometimes like it gives me anxiety. But at the same time, like, it's also calming that, wait a second, I can actually still remain connected with you. And that is a massive plus in this situation. I don't know, what have you heard from?
And that's okay, right? How you're feeling is very appropriate, with the distance giving you anxiety, but then also feeling the strange sense of calm, but also knowing what not to make out of this whole experience is extremely normal, because coming back to how this is all created by the circumstance, which is that we're in a pandemic.
Yeah.
This is the new normal now. And if you've been doing something one way for 20 something years, and then all of a sudden I tell you, no, now this is how you have to do it, it's going to be uncomfortable. It's not going to be fun.
Yeah.
And which is what it is at this point.
So what do you think then, like, once things settle down, how do you fathom transitions, you know, from this new normal that we've created for ourselves, that even to a certain extent, going on week 3 now, I'm starting to get comfortable with. How does that look like in a few weeks or months when all this like returns to like our previous state? What do you think?
I think that's going to have its own adjustment stress, like reorienting to a reality that's felt like a past reality now. Because you're right, we're getting used to this now. Like, my father struggled for the first 6 days.
Yeah.
He would just keep making these jokes about how he's going to run away one day. Now he has his own playlist of videos that he watches, because we're on day 17. He's like, well, what do we do about this now? We can't do anything, right? Which is what's one of the most beautiful parts about the human brain. It will adapt. We will adapt, right? So even with, say, you saying, okay, these are parts where I've adapted, but these I haven't, it's also because there is no processing window for like the new stressor that's thrown at you.
Sure.
You just have to go from one to another, one to another, one to another, right? Now, when the old sense of normal comes back, I'm assuming that there's still going to be some amount of anxiety to be like, for how long can we rely that it will stay like this till the next thing hits?
Yeah.
You know? So I think in some way, like, there is, depending on the kind of privileges that we have, there is some kind of security with this, that you're at least safe in your own homes.
Yeah.
You're safe from this in your own homes. At least it's not this bad. At least this like bargaining keeps happening here and there. Mm. It's going to be interesting to see how that plays out once we're able to go back to what is seen as like the baseline level of normal. I think that reorienting is also going to have some amount of adjustment. I think what it's going to also do is it's going to reshape how we view relationships.
Yeah.
How we view loved ones. And I think put things into perspective about what are the things we value.
Mm.
Right? Because there's something so existential that I have noticed in conversations in this time. People taking stock of their lives. People trying to reflect and process things they haven't done before. People reaching out to friends they haven't spoken to in 2-3 years, things like that. Like, you still don't have to do it. If you haven't spoken to someone in 2 years, you still don't have to do it now. There's something that ignites the urge to be like, okay, let me talk to this person now. Do that. Like, I think it's also reframing the way we look at relationships. We look at what is important and worthy in our own lives, and like what matters, what doesn't matter. So it's going to be interesting to see what people put into place to maintain that. Or if we maintain that at all, and we just like snap back into how things were before.
Right. And I'm actually really curious about that, because I was speaking to a friend the other day, and, you know, like, our conversation actually did head in that existential direction that you were just talking about, where, you know, we had made, well, it was conversations that are on the lines of like, oh, I had planned this, or, you know, I can't believe that all these years I didn't think about these things that really matter to me, but now I really want to. Like, what is it going to mean? So, like, just to cite, like, kind of funny example, you know, I've been holding off of getting a tattoo for like most of my life. You know, I've been thinking about the consequences, there's money, all these aspects, right? And now I'm sitting here thinking like, okay, what if this is something like this becomes the new normal? So the first chance that I get, or like the first thing that everything cools down, I'm just going to shoot for it and, you know, get my entire arm done or something like that, you know? But that's just like a funny example. But there are so many other things about maybe I want to move closer to family because I don't know, you know, something like this might happen again. And then I'm away from family for such long periods of time, or move, you know, places, or, you know, live in a better house and save little or save less. And I'm wondering about what you think might be the potential of us just overshooting right off the gate, you know, where we just go like, oh, fuck it. There's nothing else we can do right now. So might as well just go all guns blazing on life.
I think there is a high likelihood of that. But I also wonder, like, all this time that we've had to pause and reflect, like, what has led to that? As well, because sometimes I feel like in different relationships or just conversations that people are having, it's a little more uninhibited now. There's more abandon to be like, what is the worst that can happen? Like, I've been hearing a lot about like exes reaching out to other exes, and things like that, you know, or people reaching out to their parents to have very different conversations, right? So it's an also thinking about what do we categorize as overshooting, because that is so subjective. If you are someone who wouldn't have done this in this way ever, and you do it, that is overshooting for you, right? In comparison to it being overshooting for someone else. So that is a very subjective level to go off of. So overshooting might be like an extreme, but I think people might be taking more risks.
And do you think that's a good thing?
Depends on the circumstance.
It
really depends on the circumstance. I think it's interesting to see how it's reframing people's perspective on life. Because we tend to be a little more cautious also, I think, because we take it for granted that we live for a long time, right? Now it's just like 13-year-olds are dying.
Right.
And like 3-year-olds are testing positive. And all of a sudden, I was talking to a friend the other day and he was telling me about how it just feels like this apathy around death. Because you can't say goodbye to a loved one if you've lost them to COVID-19. Or we just read that Italy had 955 deaths and we're like, oh, okay, they had 970 yesterday, so it's 20 less. It's such a strange time to be alive. So I think depending on how this impacts each of us, we'll be taking different degrees of risk.
Because
it also
really
depends on how
see.
Close to home it hits, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's definitely one way to look at it. And then the other one is also that we start valuing our time far more now. Do I want to spend 20 hours of my day working in a cubicle in an office? Or do I want to go write that book that I've been writing about? Do I want to earn all the money staying like miles and miles and countries away from my family? Or do I want to take the pay cut and go stay next to my family? So a lot of things that I think we are going to get reoriented with. And something I'm really curious to see how it might pan out in my life as well, because I feel like I take risks in general. So now that this has happened, how far am I going to shoot in my perspective at least?
Which I think is also a generational shift, because there is this whole, I mean, I don't know much about Gen Z, right? But at least with this millennial generation, I think in the 20s, there has been a lot more struggle. More student loans, like everything is much more expensive. You're overworking yourself so much more, where it's like you're dehumanizing yourself just to reach up to these standards. So it's going to be interesting to see, like what you said, how it reframes that perspective, even with worth of like, what have I attached my self-worth to? Where is it coming from? Is it from a salary? Is it about how proud I'm making my parents? Is it about how many degrees I have collected? Is it about what value I'm adding to the world? Is it about my personal relationships? Like, what are my goals at all? And I think also reevaluating that, which is going to be an interesting thing to see. That's the thing, we don't know. We just don't know. It's all uncertain.
Yeah. And it's also so new, right? Like, we can't expect it to like have life-changing impacts already. Or maybe it could for some people, right? And so we just don't know. But thank you for that. The third point I wanted to touch about was separation between work and personal life. And this is something that I've been struggling so much with. And I was just telling you this the other day. It was like, it was a Saturday, and I was just like, okay, I woke up in the morning, I have some work next week, let's start on it. And otherwise, like, my weekends, I would protect no matter what. Like, that was my normal previously. Like, my weekends are my weekends. I have things planned from the morning till night, and that's it. And now I'm just like, I'm literally thinking of working to get that time passed. And on Fridays, I'm ending my night late, whereas I would have otherwise gone to a happy hour, or, you know, spoken to my mom and dad, because Fridays are off days in the UAE. So that whole separation between work and life, if there is any, is completely being shattered right now. And I see the same struggle with a lot of my friends as well, where they just go, I can't tell the difference. Mm. You have any thoughts on that? Yeah.
I think that's also a systemic issue, because this is the culture we're bred into.
Absolutely.
As well, right? You're given the age and the psychosocial developmental stages that we're at, where so much of self-worth is attached to your career, to your work, there is so much anxiety that I have seen around, I don't want to waste time. You know, I want to make the best use of this time. I want to do something more with it. Like, the whole emphasis on doing, and in not having that subjective perspective of like, this is a pandemic. If you don't do anything, that is fine. It's just difficult to unlearn, because I think this is a systemic issue where this is what we're bred into. Like, oh, you go from your bachelor's to your master's to your career, and then this is the prime of your career, and this is when you're supposed to work, you're supposed to do this, supposed to do that, which is also intergenerational to some degree, right?
Absolutely.
Because our parents had lesser opportunities than we did. So they're constantly encouraging us as well to be like, no, but do this, do that. And then we live in a really competitive world. We've had access to different opportunities, again, depending on degrees of privilege. But so much of the emphasis also then also comes down to the age and time period of our lives. Like, I cannot waste time. So I think some of that also possibly comes from there, that relationship with work is so foundational at this age and stage.
Yeah, and I think it becomes so much more apparent and like noticeable when on social media too, it's all about doing suddenly, you know, like going into day number two of isolation and, you know, staying at home, people were putting out self-help, you know, books and videos and challenges, and it was all like, it felt overwhelming to me at a certain point. And as much as I love my workouts and exercise and stuff like that, it kind of pushed me away from it a little bit. I'm like, wow, he's putting in two hours of workout during this time, making the best of this opportunity, and I'm still doing 30 minutes. Like, what's happening, you know? And I feel that pressure of doing is just compounding compounded over and over again.
Yeah. And I think that's anyway the feature of social media, right? Like, it keeps feeding this like FOMO business of like, oh, look, this is what this person's doing and you're not doing it and things like that. And then till, say, you read an article that reminds you of like, oh, this is curated life.
Yeah.
Everything you see is curated. It's perfect. It's manicured. It's things like that, right? Now think about this. Like, people are in their homes. Social media is where interactions are at. It's where like phone screen time consumption has increased exponentially, right? So people are doing different things to pass time, or I think for different reasons, when it provides satisfaction in different ways, but it also has degrees of impact on the people watching. So the pressure makes sense, because then if we come from a culture of, I don't want to waste time.
Yeah.
You know, I want to ensure that this is like 30 days that I have, that at the end of the 30th day, if I reflect, feel like I did this, and that, I finished all of this, you know, which means I didn't waste 1 month of 2020 or something like that. If that's already internalized pressure that all of us carry to some degree, now we see this and someone's putting it into action and we're having struggles with doing that.
Yeah.
That is a lot of stress as well then.
Yeah. And how do you think it also is impacting our impacting us in a way, like, I'm thinking like past this, right? Post this, my social media consumption has increased many fold, you know, and even prior to all this, we'd read about the negative impacts of social media and, like, you know, posture and phones and eyesight and all XYZ changes to brain and all of these things. But now that our consumption has exponentially increased in such a short amount of time, what do you think might be the lasting impacts of this as we go on?
I think unlearning things from a de-addiction lens is going to be difficult. Because this phone's been our best friend, or this laptop's been our best friend on so many accounts, right? It's become, we've developed an attachment to it then. Yeah. Already, I think to a large degree, we've all developed attachments to our smartphones and smart devices and things like that, right? Now, in a time like this, where for everything you have to access it again and again, your consumption has increased, which means the attachment has also deepened. I think that's going to be a big challenge, including for me, to just let go of a little more. So, say all the things that we did learn about, like, oh, it's bad for your brain in these accounts, your posture, and we get addicted on these accounts and all of that, is it's going to be information. Like, I know this, but this works for me. I've done this for so long. So I think gradually developing, like, this behavioral cycle of, like, okay, I need to start detaching from this a little more and stop going to this again and again. It's going to be so many types of starting from scratch that's going to happen for different things. I think including the relationship with the phone and the laptop and Netflix and Prime and all your screen devices. Because even to access people, to access your own parents.
Yeah.
You That's have the only to way. Do a video call. That's the only way, right? So an attachment is only natural in this time.
Yeah.
But unlearning that is going to be a challenge once this is done.
Absolutely. And I also feel like, to a great extent, that it's not just that this addiction might be a challenge to eventually unlearn and, like, you know, get yourself out of. Like, I feel like it's actively changing habits right now, you know? Like, I never used to sleep with my phone next to me. But now that's the way I feel most secure, you know? Like when anxiety settles in, when the feeling of loneliness comes in. Like, my first reaction is grab my phone, start scrolling through, you know, what people are doing. I never used to do that before. I would wake up and I would, like, my usual schedule is I'd wake up, I'd, you know, make my coffee, walk around, do my thing, stretch, whatever. But now it's almost like I wake up and I have this sense of, like, dread about, you know, it's just another freaking day of the same thing all over again. So let's just quickly jump on the laptop and, like, check out something else. Let's check the quick messages. But I feel like when that wasn't the case, I would, you know, take my time with it to a certain extent. I had time locks on all my apps previously. Now all that's gone out of the window. So I just feel like, it's settling into a pattern in behavior that even last night, I just remember, like, I went out of muscle memory to keep my phone, you know, at a different location, because I usually wake up, like, I like waking up to an alarm and, like, going up and picking my phone from a location. But then I did that from muscle memory. And then the next moment that anxiety settled in, like, holy shit, if I wake up and I feel lonely, like, I can't scroll through, I'd have to get up and, like, sit on that feeling for a little bit. And so I feel like my behavior is changing, you know?
Yeah. And I'm also wondering if that aligns with your extroverted personality, because access to connection, human connection to you right now is through that phone.
Yeah.
And I wonder what the experience of anxiety is like to not have even that. Because like you said, right, you're taken out of so many of your normal environments of, like, hanging out with a friend or traveling to some place, going to a party, doing this, doing that, right? And I think it is essential that we have some degree of human contact at this time, even if it is through a phone. So for someone who is so used to physical contact and that's just unavailable completely, I'm wondering, like, what it is like to have the security of, like, at least through, say, like, reading people's updates or going through my messages or going through social media, when I, like, see people doing things, have access to that kind of connection, how that is soothing possibly. So I'm wondering if that's what triggers a little more of that anxiety as well. What do you think?
Yeah, I, in my case, most definitely, right? Like, I feel like it's filling space. So the reason I chose to live alone, you know, is that because I have such a high degree of human interaction on a daily basis, my thinking was like, okay, so, but when I come back home, quote unquote, that this would be like my recharge station, like, where I would not interact with the world very much. I'm not going to be online as much. Relax, rest up for the next day of continuous interaction again. And now that it's been completely flipped, like, my home is no longer this
place of recharge. It is that place of where I need, you know, like where everything happens right now. So I think that's why I need these devices next to me. That because it is soothing, that because it is distracting, because it makes me, it makes me acknowledge and accept that, like, that my life right now is within these four walls physically. But when I check my phone, I know that it still extends out there into that world, and that there is that space that I can still explore, even though it's not physically.
Yeah. Do you think you'll get a roommate after this? Like a flatmate after this?
Let's see. I think it might still be
overshooting too much. Possibly.
Yeah, that might be a little too much. If things go back to a normal scenario, I'm 100% happy to like live by myself and enjoy my space. But yeah, perhaps a flatmate if things don't change too much, maybe. I like, you put me on the spot.
That's how you know it's subjective. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. You called me out on that one. But I just wanted to revisit again, like, the separation of work and personal life and things like that. I don't know if you had any tips for people that are struggling with it. How we could go about kind of distinguishing between work and, you know, not work within the same space. Because many of us depended on a physical change of environment to like reinforce that shift, right? Like, yes, when I leave my office or when I close my laptop, but now all of this is intertwined. So how, I don't know if you have any tips on that.
So I think, again, it's subjective in ways that I think employers are taking their employees for granted as well, to some degree, like sending emails at 10:45 in the night and saying, finish this now and give it to me, or calling it wee hours, going like, is this deck done? Is this presentation done? Things like that. So again, I'll come back to how that is a systemic issue. I think one thing is in also remembering that you get paid for 8 hours a day, and you're working overtime in the time of a pandemic, and reminding yourself of that again and again, that if your employers are not able to provide flexibility, that is on them. And I guess in seeing what kind of ways is this taking a toll on you, right? Because I feel like the challenge with this also is going to be in maintaining this kind of working is that it's going to lead people to a burnout, right? If we transition into this pandemic, God forbid, for the next 6 months, we're all going to be burnt out by the fact that we've been in a pandemic for over half the year and get exhausted by that. Now, if you've been trying to work 12 hours a day with that as well, imagine how bad that's going to get. I think what happens is because we're conditioned into this whole like machine-like life of like, oh, when work calls, I go, like that kind of attachment to work. I don't think we recognize how much it takes out of us. So I would first encourage people to think about, like, at the end of the day, just take stock of how much you've done in each hour of that day. Sure. Whether it is you finishing your household chores, you finishing meetings, you finishing your presentations, you folding your clothes, calling your parents, doing this, doing that, because you're working in overdrive right now already with your existence. And then you add much more work to that. It's going to be horrifying. So I think in firstly checking in with yourself to see where you're at and how this is taking a toll on you, or how you think this could potentially take a toll on you, to then be able to curate and customize a way to be able to manage that, right? So if you have to say, talk to your employer about like, look, A, B, C are my challenges. This is how much I can do. This is how much I'm struggling to do. I need an extension on this. Like, you, please meet me halfway with this. In knowing that, and in knowing that you deserve that, that is the bare minimum they can give you right now. Like, working on Sundays should never be normal, but unfortunately, it's become a new normal now. Or working after 9 p.m. was never the case, but it is now, right? And I think there is also a lot of anxiety around the fragility of people being able to retain their jobs. Which is very understandable. So I think it'll have to be going by whose situation is where. Because if, think about it, right? If you feel like you are about to lose this job, you're possibly not going to be comfortable asking and saying, hey, this is all I can do.
Absolutely
like,
not.
Just be like, no, I'm going to like burn myself out and then we'll see about that. So say, given that you are in a situation like that then, and you feel like, look, my employer is not going to be flexible about this, I still need to put in the hours, in trying to see what is an hour of your day that you can carve out just for yourself.
Yeah.
Just for yourself. It's just you doing what you would do for yourself. An hour of your day should be afforded to you. If you can do it for like 2 hours, well and good. And an hour that is not necessarily like you have to do the chores you have to do, or you have to call your parents and your friends like you have to, or you have to finish something, right? In thinking about what is like, say, a list of 10 things you've always liked to do that is just for yourself. Or even if there's 1 hour of you not doing anything, you just want to lie down, you want to take a nap in the day, you can do an hour's nap in the day. Or you want to just like sit with yourself for a while, stare at the wall, do that. You want to color for a bit, do that. You want to do a workout in that time, do that. Whatever it is, in taking stock of like, if I cannot have a flexible work schedule with my employer, if that is not something they're going to be sold on, and I get really anxious even asking that, okay, what is an hour of your day that you can consistently look forward to that is just for you? Because I think the idea of a break has also shifted, because in the time that we get off from work is when we're like, oh, I have to sweep the floors, oh, I have to finish my dishes, I have to cook lunch for tomorrow, do things like that. So you're constantly always doing something very like task oriented for the future that is going to like serve you well. Right. So we're not thinking too much about like, what is, say, if you came back from work at 9 p.m. in the night to your own space, you wouldn't necessarily, you would at least try to like carve out something that is like my space, my break,
let me do this
just for myself, right? Which has become absent now because the sense of time is so warped.
Yeah.
So in being intentional about that, and I think preparing for that, that say if it had to be 3 to 4 in the afternoon or 9 to 10 in the night, it's just for me. What is it that I would do? And then trying to see how you can be intentional about things like that might be a decent place to start.
No, that's, I think, wonderful advice. And what I'm hearing is that moving from things that you need to do to focus on that 1 hour on things that you want to do instead.
Exactly.
No, that's definitely a really great way to look at it. Because I think that that gets warped up completely, you know, like, as you said, call my mom, this, that, that. And then you're like, oh, wait, some of these were just tasks that I had to do. Some of these were things that I wanted to do. But obviously, you know, the prioritization gets completely like messed up over there in that situation.
Which is also take a nap then. Even if it is just that.
Just kind of re-energize yourself and return, I guess. But I'm glad you touched upon the employer-employee kind of conversation. I feel like this is a good segue. I've put out like a lot of my challenges there, but let's talk about things on a more of a systemic level, right? Like, what are some of the trends that you're seeing in your practice, or like things that you're observing in your research that you're coming across in general? Maybe a starting point is the employer-employee relationship. Maybe something else that you're you've noticed actively, but let's start on that, and then I have a few things that I'd love to talk about in it as well.
One thing that I have noticed is differential access to resources that people have. One is, I think, in the South Asian context, it's difficult to unlearn the stigma with mental health already. But this is of course, a physical health crisis that the whole world is going through, but there's a big mental health crisis as well that the world is going through, right, at this point. Now, when I say access to resources, it's not just with one-on-one therapeutic help. I'm also saying with access to education that, oh, this is why this is happening, and this is helping me understand what I am going through right now. Even access to education like that is differing on a lot of levels, I think, and even across age groups. Like, little kids who are used to playing from 6 p.m. to 8 p.m. at night now have to sit at home. Yeah. They don't know, they don't fully understand why they can't go to school. Things like that, you know, because these are not commonplace conversations that happen specifically in South Asian households.
For sure.
At least, right? And then if children act out, it's just like you're being too difficult.
Yeah.
Instead of it being seen as like, this is how this young child's processing stress. Right. So I think access to resources on, of course, a micro level like that, but also like a macro and ecosystem level of like, I think it's only now that I'm seeing that state governments are putting things in place for like helpline numbers. Like, I saw Maharashtra has done that now of like having a mental health helpline. I don't know how it functions, but I'm glad to see that it exists. And a lot of people have been offering pro bono services. But say in a country like India, where mental health is already so poorly funded and badly structured, I feel like people also don't know where to look for resources.
For sure.
Where do you go? Who do you talk to? Who is safe? How do you assess that this is a good clinician? How do I even know that one-on-one therapeutic work is what I want, or what is it that I am looking for, right? That is definitely one thing that I have noticed. And I think depending on geography and caste and class and like those different kind of like identity politics as well that come in, having access to resources becomes challenging, because I think it's important to have culturally congruent services.
For sure. Yeah.
Right. So that is another big challenge. So in thinking about, we're all functioning on a baseline level of stress. This COVID-19 is going to impact people differently on different levels of privilege as well, because when it comes to access to hospital resources, everything, we know how that functions, right?
Yeah.
Religion, everything. Now, a mental health crisis that is not even spoken about as much.
Mm-hmm.
You know, these conversations happen in very specific circles.
Right.
They're not happening with my house help unless I introduce it to her.
Exactly.
They're not happening with an 8-year-old unless I introduce it to the 8-year-old. So it's not normalized as much at all to be like, oh, this is also a thing that is happening. Like my 60-something-year-old father having a huge struggle with how he can't go to work.
Yeah.
And not recognizing that what he's experiencing is anxiety that now he's projecting on everyone.
Yeah.
I can't imagine the helplessness he feels, but he's also not going to be now receptive to me calling it anxiety.
Yeah.
He's going to be like, no, it's just nothing's going to happen.
Right.
So I think access to resources on all of the systemic levels, it's been interesting to see what that looks like, I guess. I think having access to social media on that front at least helps, because I'm noticing a lot of self-disclosure happening. So people talking about, okay, this is how this has been making me feel. This is what I've been going through. This is what has been helping, which I think, again, coming back to the South Asian context of like collectivistic societies, we tend to trust those narratives a little more of like, okay, you tried this, it kind of worked for you, or you went to this person, this kind of worked for you, so maybe I'll reach out.
Rather than a top down, it's like a bottom up. It's like, this worked for me, why don't you try it?
Yeah, kind of thing. I've noticed that trend has caused a little bit of a shift in one, validating ourselves and validating our communities to be like, okay, this is what we're possibly going through and these are the things we can put in place. But there could be more.
Yeah, but do you think that this time in our, you know, like in the South Asian context specifically, is an opportunity to like advance talks and understanding about mental health? Or do you think that it's getting stifled right now, especially because people are struggling with so many other things that they're putting precedence over, right? Like, obviously, in privileged circles and in terms of, be it caste, socioeconomic status or whatever, I feel like a conversation along the mental health lines can be very, like, it can be pushed, you know, because we're feeling this, we're experiencing the sadness, we're experiencing stress and anxiety. But I'm thinking of, you know, people that are struggling to make the day-to-day work in terms of like putting food on the table or being there for family, looking after their businesses or whatever, right? Like, there's so much flux right now, from people working in other people's houses to like so many different things, right? So I feel like in those, and correct me if I'm wrong here, but in those sections of society especially, that it's becoming harder to introduce these topics when especially they're struggling to make life happen on a day-to-day basis.
I think it depends on how you approach it though, and what kind of lens it is introduced with. Because just ask them how they're doing.
Yeah,
I think that's, if you take an auto and you're doing a 10-minute ride, just ask him how he's doing.
Yeah.
How are people in his home? Sometimes that's good enough, right?
Yeah.
In a collectivistic society where self-disclosure can help, and it is a sense of community that sometimes feels comforting to people, you know, across margins of privilege or within margins of privilege even, that is a powerful tool. Ask your security guard when you walk outside, be like, how are you? Did you get some water today? Did you get some food? Because you're right. Considering hierarchy of needs, it's not a priority on different levels to be like, okay, let me talk about my anxiety and like call it anxiety. But say I asked someone, like I went to the market yesterday and I lucked out with two autos that I got.
Yeah.
And both of us, it felt like we were talking to each other to like soothe each other, because I was asking him how he's doing. How's everyone at home? How's business going? And he was just like, oh, well, how are you doing? I see that you stepped out to do this and that. And that 10 minutes can feel comforting. Because you've not brought this into just like, oh, we're discussing each other's mental health kind of thing. But that's what you did. It's experiential, right?
For sure.
You go to the store, you're paying. 100 rupees to someone, just be like, hey, how are you doing? Like, I see that you've opened the store 7 days a week. Like, thank you. But how has this been going for you? Are you taking care and stuff?
Like, well, as simple as just having like a very, like a small, quick check-in. Yeah.
100%. Like when I came home yesterday and when the Ottawala and I were saying, I was just like, okay, like take care, this, that, and all. And he's just like, you know, it's not like we don't want to stay home and stay safe and take care of ourselves, you know, but if we do that, who's going to put food on our plates?
Yeah.
Absolutely. He has a valid point with that. But
for sure.
I don't know what it meant to have like 5 to 7 minutes with someone you absolutely don't know who tried to check in with you about that, to be like, hey, you have additional struggle with all of this because you're exposing yourself more and more to this. Like, how are things with you? You know?
Yeah.
So I think you can start that small.
Right. And I'm totally in agreement with you on that front. I feel like it goes a long way just having those check-ins and conversations. Mm-hmm. But I just wanted to ask you, like, do you think that, and again, like I keep projecting to the future, but maybe that's the hopeful side in me. Do you feel like because as a global society, as a nation, as a community, whatever, on all these different strata, we've been experiencing the same struggle, same as in obviously segmented, but it's the same challenge that we are facing, like in terms of isolation, inability to earn, and all of these different things. Do you think that it's going to make us a lot more empathetic towards each other? Or do you think when things... Or do you think when things return back to normal, that we go back being, you know, comfortable in our own spaces and not empathetic and you know?
I think this is going to fundamentally change something in all of us, depending on who we are, where we're at, and how we were affected by this. But I feel like this will make us more empathetic. I think... I would really hope so. I hope that it has like a heightened sense of community as well, because I think what is one of the most beautiful things that I have seen, at least so far, is the number of, say, community-led initiatives that have come up where people are trying to help each other, even if the state's not doing that or not able to do that.
Absolutely.
People are bringing their resources forward. People are trying to do all of these things, which is the practice of empathy in itself, right? Which usually also happens sometimes in cases of when you have a flood or we go through like a bomb blast or you go through something else, things like that. But this is also so different because people are losing lives. Like it comes back to that existential conversation as well of just like taking stock of like what is important, what is not, and how everything is so fragile. So I think in that scheme of things, I would really hope that this makes us more empathetic. I think to some degree it has already made us a little more empathetic than we were, because so much of the focus is also shifting now from like, I, me, myself, to like, I, me, myself, plus other people.
Plus others, yeah. Because my actions have a direct consequence on others' lives, and their actions have a consequence of my life.
Exactly. And so much is so in your face now, right? It's not like migrant laborers haven't struggled.
Yeah.
They have. But now watching of thousands and lakhs of them walking kilometers on kilometers to get home, that is in your
with
face.
With little kids and old parents and everybody on their shoulders and backs.
Yeah.
And I think to a certain extent, it's because the virus doesn't discriminate on who it attacks. And obviously, there are systems that are accessible and not accessible to certain people, but ultimately, the virus is not discriminating, right? Like, if you catch it, you catch it, and you're spreading it, and you're spreading it, right? Like, and I feel like in a certain way, that's clearly opened our eyes to, like, again, maybe it's because of the circles that I inhabit myself, but I feel like it's opened a lot of our eyes towards the plight of a lot of migrant workers and laborers, where when you watch them, as you said, you know, go all these distances, and then you realize that, wait, they were in this city that I'm living in too. And they were trying to serve me, and they were working in all these ways. Yet we're all trying to get back to our families and loved ones and stay connected in this crazy time.
Yeah, and I think you also see one. I think it slaps you across your face, of course, your face with your privilege. And two, it's such a stark reminder of like when a larger system is in place, when the government's in place, they're going to pick and choose who they take care of, right? because when you send flights to different countries to bring back students, to bring back workers from those countries, yeah. and you're just like treating them with all of this dignity, and then you see this.
You can't even have a bus for people to get back home.
Yeah, people had to start walking for you to realize that they needed buses in the first place. And then, like, they get to borders and you're, like, spraying them with disinfectant. Like, what? Like, they're insects.
How dehumanizing is that?
So dehumanizing, right? Yeah. So there are layers of oppression that have been happening for years and, like, centuries, right? Depending on the degree of privilege you and I have, we've been able to afford to, like, turn a blind eye to it. Now you can't anymore. And if after this we don't develop a heightened sense of empathy, that is going to
then be we're headed in a hopeless direction after that.
Yeah, that's very horrifying reflection of who we are then as people.
Yeah, and you know what, the weird thing is, even while I see certain pockets of empathy developing, I still continue to see some of these narratives that are like being pushed, you know, about like, you know, Muslims are bringing the coronavirus because of the Tablighi Jamaat situation. Or I see WhatsApp forwards about like weird astrological and, you know, Hindu references about like, oh, at this time, if you do this, if you do that, you know, like, oh, we fought coronavirus and it's because of Lord Shiva and Ram. And I'm just going like, people are so, well, on one hand, creative, but on the other hand, just absolutely in such a dark frame of mind where you're trying to exploit this public tragedy and lockdown to peddle your own narratives.
Yeah, because it feeds your bias.
And I see these WhatsApp forwards coming in and sometimes in my family group, and it's like, whoa, here goes 2 hours again trying to, you know, diffuse this.
Unpack this. Which is why I think there's a higher responsibility with the systems in place, right?
Yeah.
To have the basic critical thinking skills. This is your population. You need to know how you are talking to them, how you are addressing things to them. You need to be able to assume that some of this stuff is going to come up, which is why the news isn't reliable in our country. Because they will feed your bias, because it helps them get TRPs. We don't think about that because we're satisfied with our biases being fed.
And maybe you can shed a little more light about this, but there seems to be a constant struggle, and I face this myself. You know, like there are certain respected members of your family, either by age or by design or their role in your family or whatever. And there's an expectation, I think it's cultural, to just bow your heads down if they say something, you know, infuriating or inflammatory or something just completely off the left field. And if you speak up against it or you call them out on it, you're suddenly a disrespectful member of the family. And like you're on the verge of being disowned by the people that you clearly love and respect, you know. And so I've had like group chats with a lot of others, like sometimes my colleagues and other friends, but like, oh, I like this uncle said that, or my dad said this, my grandfather said this. Like, how do we reconcile this? You know, like the cultural aspect of respect versus like the reality of like dealing with like insanely bigoted comments and like trying to address those.
I wish I had one structured answer for that, because that is such a multi-layered problem, because it's again like degrees of intergenerational trauma, right? Of what we're told about authority in the households and how you are supposed to behave and how we internalize how we're perceived and how we perceive ourselves. In that account where dissent, resistance, all of these are seen as acts of disobedience and you are bad if you say this, right? If this is something now from a value system has been taught to like a 3-year-old, a 5-year-old, a 15-year-old, of course a 25-year-old is going to internalize that.
For sure.
So I think that's why that discomfort of just one being like, oof, I don't know if I can tell this uncle this, because this is what I'm going to get to hear. And also because of this whole culture we have of like, you can't tell something to one uncle because then your mother is going to tell you in a separate WhatsApp of like, oh, why are you saying anything? Keep quiet and things like that.
Exactly.
Because age is such a measure of like how much authority you have. And because they will always be older than you, you will never have enough authority in a conversation, right? You could be the most experienced virologist trying to debunk some of these myths and they would still be like, you are 20 something years old. You have not seen enough life.
Yeah.
So what are you going to do? Right.
It's a shutdown. It's an immediate shutdown.
It's a shutdown. So I think, and this is beyond COVID-19. It's in any, because India has seen so much shameless bigotry, I think, in the last few years.
Yeah.
I think it's in recognizing how you can pick and choose your battles. Because this is an individually exhaustive process. And there is one thing of like societal responsibility that we have, that this starts at home and we have to be able to unpack this. And we have to be able to address ignorance in our own homes and things like that before we go around preaching it in different places. Yes, there's only so much we can do even at home, though.
Absolutely.
There's only so much we can do. And I think it is important to see that if we need to disengage then for our own well-being, just have to do that, right? It's like, how many myths will you keep debunking? Like, how many arguments will you keep getting into?
It can't be my full-time job, you know, just like sitting in it. Sitting on WhatsApp and debunking myths for...
Yeah, and if they're going to be receptive to it, there's at least something that's going to reinforce you trying to try again. If they're going to tell you that keeping onions in every room and if the onion goes black, it means we killed coronavirus. And you're like, no, that's not how it works because here's the science behind it. And they're like, no, if you believe in something, it's going to work. Like spirituality says this or Ayush ministry says this or something like that. Then you're just like, you're fighting a losing battle.
Yeah.
So I think it's in knowing those boundaries. I think boundary setting is incredibly important.
Mm.
In challenging where you can, in noticing how much that takes out of you, what is the reinforcing factor to try again? And in also just seeing what are replenishing spaces for you to process that. Because being in a bigoted space is also exhausting.
Absolutely.
Because it changes the perception of, changes your perception of this person, no? Because then you have to now also reconcile with how you possibly don't respect them as much anymore.
Yeah. Yeah.
The way you view them has now changed, right?
For
it keeps shifting your sense of reality in the relationship with this person as well, which is a lot. So I think it's a dynamic process of seeing when to engage, how to engage, what is going to work, and when is the line I draw to be like, okay, I'm done. This is futile. This, I'm just, no. This is just an overflowing barrel that I keep throwing water in. It's the tap's not going to shut.
Yeah.
In knowing that and seeing what are safe spaces for you to process that frustration as
Absolutely. I think that's very well put, because if it's a losing battle, what's the point in like getting your head chopped off every single time, right? Like so.
Yeah.
But let's talk a little bit more about loneliness and grief, especially during this time. You know, and I read this recent article from the Harvard Business Review, and it really resonated with me. You know, it was along something along the lines of this, the thing that you're feeling right now is grief. And I was like, whoa, you know, like that is true. I am mourning something, you know, I am in grief. And I don't know what if you had any thoughts about like what trends you're seeing or like how that shift is happening in our society right now. Are more people in grief? Are more people feeling lonely? Or is this just like an immediate reaction that we're going through? Like, let's talk about it on a systemic level.
I think there's definitely an air of loneliness because this is an isolating circumstance. I think there's also a degree of helplessness, feeling like you don't have control over something. Also feeling like you don't have control over how you're processing this and the kind of emotions you have about this, some of which can fall under the umbrella of grief. Because you're also grieving so much time lost, right? Because, say, in a very different, typical circumstance, you would be doing something completely different right now. That I was supposed to move 3 weeks ago. I still have a packed suitcase there. And my flight was canceled one day before the lockdown. And I couldn't.
Yeah.
So what I often grieve is this life that I was supposed to start on a very different level. I had a house. I had everything in place. I was finally moving out of home again, like 4 months later.
Yeah.
And then now I can't. So that is my grief. So I think it's also in like time lost and how there is no control over how much time is going to be lost, how uncertain all of this, and for how long we're going to keep grieving the loss of things just by virtue of the circumstance, if that makes sense.
Right. And how much does like our current, drift towards materialism contributed to this, you think? Especially in the context of, you know, like I was having a conversation with my friend recently, and he's like, oh, I miss this thing from this place, or I miss going out to the mall to buy this, or, you know, I like my perfect Starbucks cup, and, you know, stuff like that. Like, how much of our longing has been fueled by, like, you know, materialistic indulgences that we've, you know, at least in the privileged classes, grown accustomed to?
So much, because that's why capitalism works, no?
Yeah.
We derive satisfaction from these things, and now if your sources of satisfaction are snatched away from you, they're not even taken away from you in bits and pieces, it's just like snatched away from you, it's going to leave feelings of grief, you know? Yeah. If you are used, you are attached to your tea from Starbucks every morning, you drive and you get it, and it's a moment you have, you, your tea, and your drive to work. It's gone. It's not there anymore, right?
But so it's tied to that act of, like, buying something, you know, like, of that materialism.
It's why capitalism
so
works.
Weird.
So many people were supposed to take summer vacations. They're gone. You can't do them anymore. Or so many people... yeah, there's a lot of materialistic things. So many movies are not going to be able to be watched.
Yeah.
So many things that... I think it's an also taking stock of how many people, I think, are realizing how many things they've taken for granted.
Yeah.
You don't think
given an inordinate amount of, like, space and importance in your life on the flip side. You
Like, yeah, absolutely. Both of those can coexist. You've been taking your Starbucks cup for granted and you've also attached so much worth to that one Starbucks cup that you get at 8 a.m. in the morning every day, that now that it's gone, it's such a disruptive experience in your life. Brings back to the whole existential thing, no? You're realizing, oh my God, this is what my regular day looked like, and this is were my takeaways from it, and how do I feel about that? That this is how I have functioned for the last 5 years. What does that mean about me? What do I want to keep and what do I want to remove from this? It's highly existential also, because there's something strangely apocalyptic about these circumstances.
Mm. Yeah, and it seems like in a certain way, it's like stripped us down, you know, like all the additional layers and layers of, like, things that we have put on ourselves in terms of like giving ourselves value, right? Like the watch that I wear to a meeting, or like the way I cut my hair or comb my hair, like, none of that matters anymore I'm at home.
Yeah.
So it's just such a weird and happy realization that there was just, like, it's time that we all strip ourselves down to our bare bones and, like, what is it that I need to survive? What is it that I absolutely value and I, like, need to, like, value more? Like, all this.
You know what's going to be interesting to see? How many people are able to come out of this experience with relief? Like, oh, I survived without any of these things. So these don't matter anymore, and I don't have to attach this much weight and pressure to performing in these ways. Like, I have to perform to be this person who looks like this and is this standard and that and that. And attached to materialistic things, or just, like, attached to this curated performance that we have of who we have to be in the world. It's going to be interesting to see how many people feel a sense of relief once we get out of this, to be like, I didn't do this for 3 months, still lived, I made it through this pandemic. How much of this even matters?
Yeah, that's a great insight. I feel like a common point of conversation amongst my friends right now is the lack of alcohol in our lives and the fact that we're still alive and we're still.
It's possible.
Yeah. It's possible.
You don't drink on a Friday night. You can still live.
It's okay. And and I can find other ways to, like, entertain myself, you know?
Yeah. It's so many people are talking about how they're on their way to quitting smoking because they don't have access to cigarettes.
Yeah.
And, like, when you're in that cycle, it just feels like, oh, I can never quit this. I cannot leave this. And then now, because, like I said, your brain is designed to adapt. It will adapt. It's just like, okay, cool. We don't get it.
Wow. It's so true. And it's like, I just remember, like, day one, you know, I was, like, enviously talking to my friend who had, like, stocked up on, you know, some of her booze, and I was just like, well, I don't know, I have none, you know, what's gonna happen? And, like, within a couple of days I was totally fine and I didn't even think about it anymore. But it's just that shift that has to happen, you know, and I think it is happening out of necessity for a lot of us right now,
and time, because you've adjusted now.
Yeah. What other big trends are you seeing on a systemic level that, you know, that has been more apparent to you?
I think just more connections between people.
Yeah.
Like you said. I think people who even I've known in my life who were big on like, I don't text, I can't text, I can't call, I don't do this, I don't do that, are suddenly sending you memes out of nowhere. Yeah. And you're like, are you good, buddy? Like,
should I check in on you?
Really taking a toll on you. Are you good? Like, I remember asking one of my friends, who was so bad at just like texting in general. And he just kept sending me all of these memes. And I was like, are you good? And he's just like, just go with the flow. Just go with it. Right? So I think there's just a heightened sense of connectedness that I am seeing. I think with friends and family who live in other countries, I'm also seeing like a sense of helplessness with people who are away from them. Of like, okay, are they having access to things? Like, I have a couple of sisters, my cousins who live in California, and then I have one cousin who lives in Jersey and works for an organization that is counted as an essential service. And there, and I have friends spread all over the states as well. And the way they describe things, even with like say government initiatives of a lockdown, in comparison to what you see over here, are so contrastingly different. Like even just like the impact of systemic things on that front and how it's affecting people in everyday lives. I know someone who's in Italy and who's been under lockdown for about 1.5 months now, like 40-ish days now. And she was just talking about, okay, we're used to this on this front, but you can't imagine what it is like to be in these countries right now and to just always be anxious about losing your jobs, losing your visas. Constantly being worried about if something happens to someone in one part of the world, you cannot see them. You cannot have access to them, right? I had a friend who lost an uncle to COVID-19 a few days ago. She couldn't drive from Illinois to St. Louis because she had to work in essential service. And it was just like, no, can't do this. And they're like, we couldn't even have a funeral. So I think just even on that level of like, how are we mourning? What are we internalizing about death, about loss, about distance, about just not having access to things that we have taken for granted before, right? Because it wasn't that painful before to know that people lived in different parts of the world and your friends and family in different places and that was okay. Now, I have a brother in Jersey. I have a friend with asthma in Jersey. And she's constantly making jokes about how they're all going to die. And you're just like, no, please don't say that. Yeah. Right? Because they have leaders who don't take some things seriously. Like, and even in my personal caseload, with my patient time caseload, right? People living in other countries. Like, I know of someone who said that in the States, he had about 800 people in his county. Whoa. And he's like, I don't know how many people, and it's not even New York or Jersey. It's one of the neighboring states. If like, there are like 800 people in my county. I don't know how many people are on the next street. The anxiety of like, okay, going to a store and getting something. What can you touch? What can you not touch?
Yeah.
So I think even systemic interventions country-wise and how they have been impacting people, like the people I see in Singapore are just like, this is life as usual. Like, we're out there in the bars, we're chilling. Nothing's made a big difference to us.
Yeah, my friends in Hong Kong are like slowly returning back into like, you know, going to restaurants and going on hikes and stuff like that.
Yeah, and I went yesterday outside and it's ghost town in Bombay, right? So even knowing that this is a pandemic happening across the world, like the levels at which it is in different parts of the world and the kind of interventions that are in place is also something I think that allows people to trust the system that they're in to know what they can and cannot do. Like I was watching this video of this 26-year-old in New York yesterday talking about her experience within the system after she developed symptoms. Horrifying.
Horrible. Yeah.
Horrifying, right?
Yeah.
So scary. And she was talking about how it is a big myth that, oh, like it's only if you're young and you have pre-existing conditions that this is going to mess you up. Like I have none and this is what it was like for me. And now to consume all of that news and to know you have loved ones in those spaces and to know how much testing costs over there.
Yeah.
And also in the systemic front of like, again, people I've been working with, but also family in different places who are on H-1B visas, going like people are starting to get fired.
Yeah.
If I get fired, I can't leave the country and come back to India because India's borders are locked.
Exactly.
I don't have access to health insurance. So how am I supposed to pay in case I test
positive?
Anything.
Oh my goodness.
So it's so
wild, wild,
many
wild,
challenges.
Wild. Yeah.
That you
and especially
have
with a lot of startups. Sure, for sure. Especially with a lot of startups and like businesses that don't see a way out, especially in this kind of scenario. There's really no other way than for them to like unfortunately lay off people, and for people that get laid off are just left stranded without any opportunity to take care of themselves. But do you think after this essential services are going to be given the kind of respect and value that they should have been given all this while? We've taken our doctors for granted, our nurses for granted, our schools and teachers and garbage collectors and security guards for granted. Do you feel like we will finally come around to like giving them the kind of respect and kind of payments that they actually deserve?
I want to be hopeful, but history doesn't give me a lot of evidence for that, that is something that has happened. Because these are also the people who suffer the most in the times of a crisis like this. So, of course, now because we're still benefiting from them, like, we're like, oh, okay, like, we recognize the value of this and everything. But I think once we go to business as usual and we've all adapted to that kind of life, I really hope that happens. But again, history has not given me enough evidence. And, like, whether in the time that I've lived in India, the time I've lived in the States as well, like, these oppressive cycles have continued through a lot of world crises. So I don't know about that. I hope so, but I think when it comes to say wages and benefits and access to care and things like that, I think we're still pretty far away.
Yeah,
because that's a lot of systemic changes that should have been put in place by now, right? See, even in the South Asian context with India, it's not like they've not suffered through floods. It's not that we've not had a TB epidemic. It's not like we've not had different crises that have happened where systems and us as communities have had a chance to put these things in place. But we're still the kind of people who will be like, oh, but why should the help's money not be cut for 2 days that she didn't come when they work 7 days a week?
Yeah.
I think that's very like baseline things we should have had by now, which we don't as a community, as a society. We tend to take, it's a cycle of oppression. We're all complicit in it.
Yeah.
So while we can all hope and reflect and be like, oh, and all of these articles and these social media posters can come out about like, oh, don't call them this, they're essential workers for this reason, respect them for this, that, and everything. It's great in theory, but our own government failed so many of them.
Yeah.
You didn't even think about them.
And continues to fail them on a daily basis.
Exactly, right? The systems are designed to fail them.
Yeah.
And they know that, which is really unfortunate. Like, there was this vegetable vendor who came a few days ago, and he was talking about how the cops had hit him and everything. And he really asked me this really profound question where he was like, if we don't sell, what are all of you going to eat?
Yeah.
What are you?
And yet they are the ones who get beaten up.
Exactly. Yeah. It felt like he was hiding in our apartment building. And then he was telling us about how he hadn't eaten food and everything. So we packed him some food, gave him some extra money and all of that. And he was just surprised by it.
Yeah.
And what I learned from that is he doesn't even expect that much.
Yeah.
He expects to be beaten. He expects the exploitation because that is what they've been given. All along, the systems are designed to fail them, right? So even if they get like an ounce of help from somewhere, they're like, what?
Yeah.
Really? It's the bare minimum anyone can do. Pack him some food, get him some water, thank him, give him some extra money and be like, hey, stay safe. But he's just like, no, they don't do anything for us, but we'll survive.
Which is so disappointing. It's so disappointing. And especially like on the level in which the police have been like, you know, misusing their power and positions along with, you know, politicians and all of this. It's just, it's heartbreaking to see. And to the extent that just a few days ago, so my the security guard who works in the evenings over here, there's been some issue with like where he can get access to water from. So he's been coming every evening to my place, and like, you know, I've been giving him you know, I fill up his water bottles and, you know, occasionally I've been giving him like, you know, cookies or like little package stuff that he can take with him in case his tiffin doesn't arrive the next day or something like that. And it's almost as if, you know, like he is just so thankful that somebody's even taking that step, you know, and that's honestly just.
And to me, that's a little shameful to experience that, because I'm like, wow, the standards are so low.
Yeah.
They don't even expect the bare minimum.
The fact that I just gave him a pack of cookies and like that alone, he keeps talking about for like several days on stretch, you know.
Yeah, exactly, it's
unfortunate. Yeah.
And it comes, that's why I said, it comes down to the bare minimum of just ask them how they're doing.
Yeah.
You don't have to tell them about like, oh, these are the symptoms you're possibly having and these are the places you could go to get help or call this helpline or this, that, right? Mm-hmm. Just ask them how they're doing. Like if you have a security guard in your building who's been sitting outside for a while or is like, they're all wearing masks as well. And those masks are suffocating after a while, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Ask them if they're feeling dehydrated. What do you need? Like, you know, do you need a plate of food? Like, how is everyone at home? Where is your family? The things you would ask your friends and family, right? Why shouldn't they? That's basic empathy. Why shouldn't they deserve that?
Absolutely.
Starting that small.
Yeah. And it's just frustrating. But while we move towards winding this down, just wanted to ask you quickly as to if you had any thoughts on your mind, tips, suggestions for people that are living in social isolation and social distancing, if you had any quick takeaways for people like us to do with.
I think it's in first checking in to see what is a doable routine, what is a flexible, doable routine that is possible. So say you woke up at 8 a.m. and you worked from 9 to 5 usually on a regular day.
Yeah.
If you don't have the energy to wake up at 8 a.m. and you wake up at 9:30, like, is that okay? If it is, then wake up at 9:30. I think in like using this whole lens of cutting yourself slack, I think routine is useful. But I think in times like these, it is a very unrealistic expectation to have a very rigid routine. It's not going to happen. And then if it doesn't happen, it's going to increase feelings of helplessness and like loss of control and things like that. So if it doesn't happen, it's not your fault. It's a feature of the circumstance, and the circumstance is designed to stress you out. So I think in seeing what is a doable routine that you can have in place and how much, and then allowing yourself flexibility for it. You don't have to go Monday through Friday doing the same thing. If things moved around, if you had like a realistic list of things you had to do, like you cleaned your house once in 2 days over cleaning it every day.
Yeah.
You know, deadlines can be pushed a little here and there. Okay, fine, let me do that. You know, you cooked one meal that lasts for two meals, so you don't have to cook again. You did your dishes once a day. Stuff like that, you know, and like cutting yourself slack to be like, listen, you're surviving a pandemic. You're allowed this much. It's okay. I think too is in seeing how you can intentionally maintain human contact, whether it is through your phone calls, your video calls, if you have roommates, family at home, spending time with them, because I think access to social support systems has become limited in its ways. So I think it's important that we maintain that as intentional as, okay, I will, if I feel this way, I know these are the people I can call. But even if I'm having a good day and I want to share it with someone, these are the people I can call. And stuff like that. App House Party is so popular for
that reason, I love it.
Right?
Yeah.
Right? Exactly.
Yeah, it's so fun. Yeah.
Exactly. And if that helps you have, like you said, half an hour of fun, you deserve half an hour of fun.
Yeah.
As well.
Absolutely.
Right? So I think in maintaining like intentional human contact, and if you manage to do your basic activities of living in a day, maintaining hygiene, eating your food, sleeping as much as you can, that itself is a victory. You did it in the time of a pandemic. Fantastic. Anything more than that is a bonus. So double the applause for that. In also knowing that, right? In treating yourself with compassion and empathy, as you would with the person you love the most in this world.
For sure.
If that's what you would afford them, in also being intentional of how you provide that for yourself. I think because there's a lot of guilt around, like, I don't want to waste time and productivity guilt and things like that. In just knowing that this is the time you have to cut yourself slack. Like, it's okay with how much you can do, how much you cannot do. if you are having heightened stress, in knowing that therapy is available in a lot of spaces, in looking it up, in talking to people who have been to therapy and reaching out for help. I know there are, at least in India, I've seen that people have been offering pro bono services and things like that to see where that is accessible, because I think it is important and beneficial in having a space where you are able to process what you're going through.
For sure.
Another thing is that if you are having like pockets of heightened stress that you experience, whether it is anxiety or just regular other kinds of stressors that set it off in motion, in seeing what are grounding activities that you can do in day. I'm a big advocate for grounding activities like that. And a grounding activity is something that is characterized by repetitive action and something that engages you for a while, which is the only thing that you do. So of course, say workouts can be grounding for that reason, and they feel like they really center people for a while. Meditative exercises do that as well. But it can literally be with something as simple as when you have your cilantro coriander leaves, like you separated that from the stalk.
Yeah.
Something as simple. Fold your clothes. Rearrange something. As long as it is the only thing that you do for, say, like 10 to 12 minutes, like cooking, a lot of people say is really helpful for that reason. And it feels grounding. Because the key is in repetitive action. And you're doing it for like a designated amount of time is just you.
I've been relying on that a lot too. Like just, you know, cutting vegetables has been like this new joy of mine that grounds me and like...
Exactly. Because the whole science behind grounding is that it brings you back to your body. It brings you back to the present moment. Because when we look at it as a spectrum, anxiety and uncertainty and all of that is the fear of the future. When it comes to, say, sadness, upset, depressive symptoms, all of that can sometimes be grieving the past. Life happens in the present with both. So it's in being able to manage that and being able to check in with yourself. And what grounding activities can do is that they can help you just get back to the present. So say if you are feeling heightened uncertainty, feeling a lot of anxiety about different things, and you are now focused on this one activity, even if it is like scribbling, coloring, whatever it may be, something that is repetitive action that you are, say, able to do for 15 minutes of your day, and you did it four times in different parts of the day, that's 1 hour. That's it. 15 minutes of your time. Just do that much. Like center, be with yourself for that time. Just so your brain has some time to replenish from everything.
And it seems so much more doable when you break it down that way, right? Like when I think about like, oh, taking an entire hour for like coloring versus like do it like in four different, you know, stretches or whatever.
Yeah, do it in four different stretches. Like anything that has like repetitive action. Like a lot of times, like braiding your hair, applying lotion, doing so many things that you do, right? The key only is that don't watch something when you do it or play music in the background.
Just focus on that one thing.
Just do that one thing that feels engaging, is repetitive, and really just grounds you. And your body will let you know.
Yeah.
Every feeling response that you have happens first in your body. Right. Your mind is not some mystic, oh, this thing kind of thing. It's all your body. Your brain's in your body. Your body in itself is there. And for you are having, say, heightened symptoms of like your heart rate increasing or you feeling really keyed up or anything like that, anxiety is a protective feeling response. Your body is on your side in those moments. It's just that it doesn't have to go into fight or flight. And that's where grounding exercises work, where you're able to practice rational thought to bring yourself back into your body, to be like, okay, I'm good. I'm safe in this moment. I have control over this. And this is what life looks like. I think another thing is focusing on things you can control.
Yep.
I think we live in a time where there's a lot that we can't control and we're constantly reminded of that. So every day trying to take stock of what are things I can control, even if it is as simple as, okay, like I can make my meal on this account. I can work for 3 hours here. These are the areas of control that I have. I can wash my hands in these ways and everything. And lastly, if a big source of your anxiety is what if I get it or what if one of my loved ones get it, and I did this for myself because I'm 27 and I'm high risk. I developed something that's like a COVID-19 action plan for myself. And we're actually working on like doing like a template model that people can just utilize and create for themselves. But a COVID-19 action plan looks something like, okay, worst case, I was supposed to get it. I made a list of who are the first 2-3 doctors I would call to just confirm my symptoms. What is the nearest lab? What is the nearest quarantine center? My parents are in their 60s. It's like, okay, they're also high risk. So who is able to take care of them if they're isolated? Who are a couple of friends I can rely on to take care of things for me in case I have to get admitted?
This is wonderful, yeah.
Yeah, I created like a full COVID-19 action plan for me, for my parents. And like I said, we're designing like a little build that people can just have and like customize and keep with themselves. Because I think a big source is that, oh my God, what if I get it? And then we're trying to think of like, no, this is why I won't get it. We live in a really fragile time where you could get it. So I think I've noticed that at least for me and just across the board where I've suggested it, like it's been beneficial to know that you can still have some control if you get it. Which is
and be prepared for it, right? Like there's nothing wrong in
COVID-19 action plan. There's no harm in it, and keep it somewhere, right? Keep it on your notes app, keep it somewhere you can keep. So even if your symptoms worsen, you are breathless and you showed it to someone and they know who to call and what is to be done, that can feel a little soothing. So those are my few broad suggestions.
Those are incredible. Like I think there's at least, especially the last one, I'm definitely taking up, but I would say almost every one of them, I'd probably start on it right away. So thank you so much, Ruchita, for that. But before I let you go, quickly, if you had any book that you're reading that you'd recommend, it can be related to this topic, it can be completely unrelated, something that's given you joy, music, movie, anything along those lines. Recommendation.
See, I would have prepared for this if you had told me you were going to ask me this.
That was the point of catching you off guard on this.
Oh my God. So I am someone, because I do a lot of trauma work, the things I consume are very just like feel good, like chill kind of things. Right? Yeah. So one of the recent things that I just watched was Kim's Convenience.
I've seen it. It's God, so I love chill. That show. Yeah, it's such a good
so
show.
So much, right? I such also, God, I forget the author's name, which is so strange. I will send it to you, though. Yes. I'm also reading this book called The Examined Life, which is a psychoanalytical therapist's account of like multiple cases he's had. I think it's a beautiful book because it shows the power of deep psychological work. It's snippets from these cases. It's how he frames how the human mind functions, the brain functions, in very like simplified language to see, okay, like everyone has stressors. These are ways in which it can manifest. It's called The Examined Life. I forget the therapist's name. He's a psychoanalytical therapist.
No worries. I'll put it down in the description.
Is what I watched recently, which was fantastic. So I would recommend watching things like that. A lot of people have been watching Money Heist. I'm just like, I don't need to watch something with chaos when my work has a lot of it anyway.
I totally empathize with you on that. But before I let you go, where can people find you? Where should they search for you? How can they contact you?
Sure. So I do a lot of mental health education based work on Twitter, where my handle is ROCHEETAH. It's how my name was pronounced in the US, so I just like made it into my handle.
You just like leaned into it.
It was always Rushita, and then I was just like, okay, let's do it. So Rushita, you can find me there. I do a lot of mental health education based threads and work over there, and anything I write for different publications as well gets circulated. It's the easiest way to get in touch there because that also has my email address in case somebody wanted to reach out for individual work or to collaborate for any projects.
Perfect. I'll put it down on the description. Ruchita, this was amazing. Thank you so much for joining us.